You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a business-led movement to give employees time to go vote is gaining momentum. We'll talk to representatives from two of the founding companies about their goals. Now, an Illinois teenager has been arrested on suspicion of shooting and killing two people and injuring a third during violence in Kenosha last night. According to a complaint filed in Lake County, Illinois, 17-year-old Kyle Rittenhouse is charged with first-degree intentional homicide. Under state law, he would be charged as an adult. That came after 3 days of protest and three nights of violent activity since the shooting of Jacob Blake by Kenosha police on Sunday. Blake, a black man, is in a Wauwatosa hospital. Yesterday, his father said that Blake is paralyzed from the waist down. Doctors don't know whether that would be permanent. Blake's encounter is being investigated by the State Justice Department's Division of Criminal Investigation. It said it hopes to present its findings to prosecutors within the next month. Jim Palmer is executive director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association, the state's largest law enforcement group. Jim, welcome back to the show.
Good afternoon.
And Jim, one point of clarification. First of all, I believe the Kenosha Police are one group that your organization does not represent. Do I have that correct?
That is correct, yes.
Okay. Now, first of all, your reaction to Sunday's incident and the days that have followed.
Well, I think, you know, first and foremost, I mean, our hearts go out to all those that are impacted by the shooting of Jacob Blake. You know, we recognize that, you know, the pain that this incident has caused Mr. Blake and his family. And we also acknowledge the concerns of those that are troubled that, by the actions depicted in the traumatic bystander video of the incident. You know, we understand, I believe, how, you know, that kind of video is emblematic of an experience that's familiar to many Americans of color. And, you know, we regret the hurt that this incident and those that those like it, that it has continues to inflict. I think at the same time, we also recognize that law enforcement officers are, you know, doing a very difficult job. And, you know, there is an investigative process, as you well know, in the state of Wisconsin that's unique compared to most places around the country. We have a state law that mandates an independent investigation by an outside agency. You just mentioned the State Department of Justice. And that process ought to be allowed to run its course. You know, I don't think it anyone benefits from drawing conclusions on the limited information that we have, although people are right to have their questions. And the outcome of the Sunday incident is, you know, it is tragic, regardless of the circumstances. But when it comes to a legal assessment of the officer's conduct and whether that was appropriate under the law, the circumstances do matter. And there's a lot of information that needs to be collected and gathered and examined very closely.
We've talked to you a lot, Jim, about this state law that requires these outside investigations, about the origins of that law. Can you remind us why that came into existence and a little more about how it works?
Absolutely. That was a long, multi-year effort on the part of many people. In large part, I have to give credit to Michael Bell, a gentleman out of Kenosha whose son was shot by Kenosha officers in 2004. And he received a settlement as a result of some litigation that he initiated against the city of Kenosha. He used that settlement, those settlement funds, to start a public campaign. And he and I came together sometime thereafter. And I think along with many others, I don't want to diminish the contribution of other groups, but I think you know, our ability to come together and reach across the blue line, so to speak, has, you know, helped establish a meaningful reform that protects both the public and protects the officers that serve them as well.
And we've heard from Governor Evers. He proposed some police reforms earlier this summer after the killing of George Floyd. We've heard from Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss saying he's forming this task force. You have said in statements there's room for both of those. What are you hoping to see come out of this at the state level?
Well, you just said it very well. I think, you know, we believe that both the approaches outlined by Governor Evers and Assembly Speaker Voss are not mutually exclusive. You know, we appreciate the fact that Governor Evers has identified a number of proposals and he has a certain urgency that he wants the state to begin taking steps to act on those measures. We support his interest in doing so. Speaker Voss, by contrast, wants to convene a task force to kind of take a broader, more systemic kind of examination. And we think that has value as well. And we ought to pursue both, quite frankly. And we think, you know, the problems of systemic prejudice that exists in this country and the disparities that exist, policing is certainly a part of them, but it is, not the root cause of many of the problems that we're facing as a nation. And we really need to have a systemic, an examination that looks for a systemic set of solutions to what everyone seems to agree is a systemic problem.
Talking to Jim Palmer, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association, about the events over the last few days in Kenosha. Jim, there are certainly people in Kenosha, black people around the country, who are worried that the police aren't there to protect them, that the police are a threat to them. And then the protests, people saying it looks like the police are, you know, more friendly to armed counter protesters, treating them with kid gloves, treating the protesters themselves more harshly. What would you say to them in those concerns?
Well, I really can't comment on whether or not there's a distinction between how officers are treating one group over another. I think, you know, the officers in Kenosha and those that have been working there are in a difficult spot in the sense that they are spread very, very thin and attempting to, on the one hand, protect lives, protect property, protect the public, and on the other, also allow people to exercise their rights to free expression. When they're spread as thinly as they have been, with some people engaging in destructive and violent actions, and I think it's difficult for law enforcement to be everywhere. So I don't know to what extent they've treated one group different than another. I think clearly I'm pleased that someone was taken into custody with regard to the shootings that occurred last night. And, that should I'm sure there'll be some accountability that needs to be, meted out as a result of those actions.
Let's bring on a caller. Steve is with us in Sun Prairie. Steve, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I just was curious about the guest's position and his thoughts about our great Governor Evers, who sends out a inflammatory tweet saying, "I don't have all the facts in," and then starts talking about discrimination from a guy whose own decision of resisting arrest ended up with him being shot, where now he fanned the flames, knew this was going to happen, and didn't put enough law enforcement in place to protect property and people in Kenosha.
Steve, thanks for the call. And again, one part of the story that isn't clear was whether he was being arrested. But I want to read the excerpt of Governor Evers' tweet that Steve is referring to. Quoting here, "While we do not have all of the details yet, what we know for certain is that he is not the first black man or person to have been shot or injured or mercilessly killed at the hands of individuals and law enforcement in our state or our country," end quote. And Steve is not the only person, Jim, to find that inflammatory. What do you think?
Well, we share his assessment, frankly, especially as it relates to that statement. I don't think the governor's statement there or those like it by others are very helpful. I don't think they do much to contribute to a constructive public dialogue on these issues. To essentially say, even though we don't have all the information, this looks just like yet another merciless killing at the hands of a Wisconsin law enforcement officer is very inflammatory. And I think it is, frankly, uncalled for. I think it is emblematic of the fact that we need more leaders in this country at every level. And this isn't a Republican or Democratic thing, to be able to say that, it's okay to support the fight for social justice and, the measures to address systemic disparities that exist in our country. And at the same time, support law and order and support the fact that the vast majority of men and women in the law enforcement profession do their jobs honorably and at great risk to their personal safety. And so I think, any statements about whether it's police officers or even protesters that paints individuals and groups with a broad brush does nothing to elevate the public discourse to really where it needs to be if we want to affect meaningful change.
In our last few moments, Jim, what do you see? What do you hope to see comes out of this?
Well, very much we would like to see the special session take place, and we'd like to see a Wisconsin begin to take some meaningful steps. To continue actually taking some steps. I think, the law that we passed in 2014 was very productive and first of its kind in the country. We need to build on that. I think we have a proud history of being progressive in this state, not only as a state, but as a law enforcement community. We ought to be looking at what we can do in the short term and the long term to affect meaningful change in a way that not only protects the public, but protects the officers that risk their safety to serve the public.
Jim, thanks for joining us again today.
Thank you.
Jim Palmer is executive director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association. We talked to them about the shooting of Jacob Blake by Kenosha police and the protests and then violence in the city that have followed. Coming up, we'll talk to a Wisconsin teacher who received a national award for his efforts to teach Menominee traditional arts to his students. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, a teacher from Menominee Indian High School in northeastern Wisconsin received a prestigious national award. We'll find out how he's keeping traditional arts alive for his students. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum talking to the author of a new critically acclaimed collection of essays that explore Midwestern complexities like gender and softball.
Even though 2020 has been a year, Melissa Falavino has had some bright spots this summer. The New York City writer released her debut essay collection, Tomboyland. It's a deep dive into identity, zeroing in on gender and sexuality. Falavino's complexities unfold as she explores her life growing up in Mount Horeb, Wisconsin, digging into her love of meatballs and softballs, moths and tornadoes. Another bright spot of the summer? It was when we talked during her visit to Madison a few weeks ago.
Oh my God, we are in my absolute favorite place on the planet, which is at Olbrich Park, sitting in center field in Packer chairs that Maureen brought. It is actually a perfect day.
It really is. Falavino and I met at the Olbrich Park softball fields mostly because of the pandemic, but also because she writes about the sport's impact on her in Tomboyland. Here's an excerpt from the essay, Switch Hitter.
In the Midwest, softball is something of a hallowed thing for girls. Here in America's heartland, where so many girls are born and raised by generations of farm families, their bodies built for baling hay, their shoulders broad, their backs and hands strong, their muscles long and lean, like they were born to play ball, like they came out of the womb with gloves on their hands, cleats already digging into the dirt. Growing up in a small town where boys were boys and girls were girls, playing softball also meant being called a lesbian. This was the worst possible insult, one we worked hard to combat. It meant applying too much makeup, even and perhaps especially before games, making sure our hair was just right, straightened and sprayed at lockers between class, wearing short skirts and high heels and low-cut shirts on game days. All this to assure the boys and the men that even though we played softball, we were still girls, that we were sexy, available, and straight, that our bodies were objects for them to desire.
Can you explain why you decided to write that section?
Yeah, I mean, I knew that I wanted to write about softball because it was such an important part of my life, and I knew it was complex.
You were a big deal in the Mount Horeb world of softball.
In the world of small-town sports, I was something of a big deal. You know, it was my life, and it was my plan, and I was going to go play D1 softball at UW, and I got close and then totally failed, and the whole trajectory of my life changed. You know, everything that I sort of expected I was going to do and be didn't happen. And I took this totally different route and became a writer. And there's still some grief, though, you know, like and I grieve that life, that playing the sport competitively like that, what that did for me as a kid. And so I knew that I wanted to write about that. But then I was like, oh, there's so much more here. So I get into the ways that we as girls, when we're young, we learn to perform under the male gaze. And even if it's not told to us explicitly, we learn it implicitly. And like everything that we do, maybe especially in a small town, about being desired and being attractive and being popular and being objects for boys and, you know, sometimes even adult men to want. And it's a pretty vulnerable piece, and there's a lot of things that I still am, like, freaked out to have in the world. And there are days when I'm like, why would I do that? Why would I write that? But the cool thing has been having predominantly women, a lot of queer women, you know, writing me and saying, like, oh, man, I identified so hard with this, and, like, I feel like you were writing my story, and it's such a ubiquitous thing, girls playing sports, you know, but there's so much complexity there, especially within the realm of identity and the body and desire. So
that was Melissa Falavino, author of the new essay collection Tomboyland. She's a Mount Horeb native who now writes, teaches, and plays music in New York City. Want to hear a longer conversation with Falavino? Tune in to this weekend's Beta on WPR, where we talk about empathizing with moths and what it means to turn your body into a machine. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, we talked with Ben Greeno about 2 years ago when he was named Wisconsin's Teacher of the Year. Now in 2020, he's received another award, this time a National Human and Civil Rights Award from the National Education Association. Ben Greeno is a teacher of traditional Menominee arts at Menominee Indian High School. He uses Menominee language, culture, and art to promote and preserve tribal history as a pathway for future generations and to positively influence the education of the youth in his community. Ben, welcome back and congratulations.
No, bonsoir, Rob. How are you?
Well, tell us a little bit about the students and your community there at Menominee Indian High School.
Oh, they're amazing. It's going to be a little bit different this year for us. My students this year are going to be both in school and online, virtual, and we're doing kind of a mixed bag of two days on, 3 days virtual, and we're splitting the community up, and it's going to be interesting. It's going to be hard, and it's new, and but we're a resilient people, and the resilience is built right into the students, and they're going to be able to do well. And I think that that as far as like an education goes, and delivering education to our kids, we're going to be finding new ways to reach them.
And now you are an art teacher, technically, but it sounds like there's a lot of history and culture and archaeology and even math that goes into your work. Could you tell us about what we would learn if we were in Mr. Greeno's class?
Okay. Yeah, well, I'm trying to figure out new ways to reach the kids. One of the ideas comes from a philosophy from the Grand Ronde people in Oregon. They said that we're not raising children, we're raising elders. And I've been thinking a lot about that lately, about how do we instill the values of our elders into our kids in school? How can we help our parents, our grandparents, our aunts, uncles, our community to raise kids that are kind of ambassadors of our culture and really merge with what who we are as Menominee people? So, I'm thinking about doing a traditional garden in my own personal homestead. I've tried that this year, doing it's a ridge and furrow. It's kind of like a raised bed garden. We have them in our Menominee forest that are thousands of years old, and we have this huge agricultural, knowledge, traditional ecological knowledge, and to reconnect our kids with that. Using math, using science, using our history, and getting them out and being active and social distancing and, providing something that's going to build community, strengthen our community, and give back to our community. I think those are the things that that our people are looking for in our kids.
And you've also used some Menominee arts and crafts as part of your curriculum. What kind of things have you worked with your students on over the years?
Oh, I've been working on this project looking at Menominee beaded belts and looking at the geometry that's included in there. So we do a design program on the iPad. It's just a real simple using an Apple Pencil and filling in dots, but also talking about Pythagorean theorem and area and reflections over a line and trying to bridge some of the knowledge that they're learning here in the high school with our traditional understanding of geometry. It's really fascinating, and then they get to actually do the beadwork and think about that and make those designs so that maybe they'll remember some of those formulas that they need for such an ACT or something like that.
Well, you've had, as I mentioned, statewide recognition. What was it like to learn that you'd received this national award for human and civil rights from the National Education Association?
It was overwhelming. you know, it's really nice to be recognized, and I felt really humbled, and I thought that it's going to be a great opportunity to showcase my students and showcase our community, and I guess bring a little bit of attention to the things that we're doing, the things that we're working on through education and through community building.
Now it sounds like you have more than a full-time job already. I understand you're also working on your doctorate in First Nation Studies at UW Green Bay. Can you talk a little bit about how that fits into your goals and your hopes as an educator?
Yeah, it's really opening my eyes. I've been kind of a lifelong student, and it's taken me many, many years, and I have many, many credits built up because it have this like this yearn for learning new things, a yearning for that, and I want to instill that in my students and to show them that that our education can be something that that builds who they are and builds their character, and can give back to our community, and I'm learning a lot of things through our First Nations education program at UWGB about respect and responsibility and reciprocity and relationships. They call it the four R's. And I'm going to be building that into our curriculum for this year and thinking about what the standards are of education, especially in a traditional arts program, which is, I don't know if there are any other traditional arts programs in the state of Wisconsin. So it's kind of a lonely enterprise, but it's really cool because I get to, build it the way I think that build upon it, the way that I think that our elders would appreciate and respectful to who we are as Menominee people.
Ben, thanks so much for sharing your work with us today.
Thank you so much. Wawanin.
Ben Greeno is a teacher of traditional Menominee arts at Menominee Indian High School. He's the 2019 Wisconsin High School Teacher of the Year and a recipient of a 2020 National Education Association Human and Civil Rights Award. Coming up, we'll look at a corporate movement to get more people time off to vote on Election Day. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, join Keely Boltina and her guest for a local perspective on the police shooting of Jacob Blake and the protests and violence that have followed. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, more people are expected to vote by mail this year than in the past, but a lot of voters will still go to the polls. And Election Day itself remains a regular workday, not a holiday. There have been calls over the years to make it a holiday or move voting maybe to the weekend. In the meantime, a growing group of companies is making a pledge to make it easier for their employees to vote. Coca-Cola is one major company that recently joined that list after prodding on Twitter from comedian Sarah Silverman. The company announced it'll give employees the day off on Election Day. There's a movement now of more than 700 companies to increase voter participation by giving workers time to cast their ballots. We'll hear today from two of the three founding companies of the Time to Vote movement, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Does your workplace make it easy in some way for you to vote on Election Day if you're an employer? What do you do? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Corley Kenna is the Senior Director of Global Communications and PR for Patagonia. Corley, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Franz Pasha is Senior Vice President for Corporate Affairs for PayPal. Franz, thanks for being with us.
Glad to be here, and thanks very much for including us.
Corley, let's start with you. Can you talk about how this movement, this Time to Vote movement, got started?
Sure thing. So in the summer of 2018, a handful of business leaders from several companies, including Patagonia and PayPal, really came together around this idea that the business community could play an important role in helping to increase voter participation in our elections. We recognized that what worked for one company wouldn't necessarily work for all companies, and so wanted to offer something flexible but meaningful. And really, it was all about helping to ensure that no worker has to choose between earning a paycheck and voting. In 2018, we had over 400 companies. This year, we're hoping to have over 1,000 companies joined by Election Day.
And Franz, what would you say to people with other companies, you know, thinking about giving it a try or who haven't thought about it at all?
Yeah, I mean, we have found that the response has been tremendous from leaders of companies and from employees of companies. And it makes a difference to employees to understand that their companies support civic engagement and that being part of a community within a democracy, that it's really important that everyone has the ability to participate and to have their voices heard in our political process. So I think it's part of the way companies can engage in their communities and take that measure of civic responsibility. It means a lot to employees.
Coralie, you mentioned each company might do this differently. Can you tell us what Patagonia does to give workers time to vote?
Sure thing. So at Patagonia, we first shut down on Election Day in 2016, and that includes our retail stores across the country, as well as our headquarters and our distribution center. And we did that in 2018 because of the positive feedback, and we'll be doing that again in 2020. There's other things that we're doing this year because of the pandemic, and that includes providing resources for people to vote by mail and making sure that all of our Patagonia community understands the dates and rules around that.
Now, Franz, PayPal is a different kind of company. I imagine there has to be some kind of staff on call 24/7. Yeah. How have you managed this time to vote issue at PayPal?
Yeah, we've got a full program that we call PayPal Votes. On Election Day, we'll be providing employees with paid time off for half a day so that we'll be able to cover, as we do 24/7, all of our customer service needs. But that half a day can be used for voting or for working at the polls because a lot of people will vote early or will vote absentee during this work from home era or vote by mail. So for us, it's about civic engagement. We also, and we've learned a lot from Patagonia as well in this, we've all been learning from each other, which has really been a really positive part about this, but we also will provide a lot of education, and the opportunity for our employees to sort of understand what are the election law rules, what are the rules about voting by mail, absentee, when do the polls open and close, how can they, get involved in helping to support, the polls on Election Day. All those things really matter. And also helping people register, making it very easy to register. We can play a part in that.
We are talking to Franz Pascha from PayPal and Coralie Kenna from Patagonia, two of the founding companies of the Time to Vote movement, encouraging companies to, whatever works for them, provide time for employees to vote on Election Day. Coralie, we're dropping a lot of big names of companies here. Are you just looking for big players or are you reaching out to smaller businesses as well?
We welcome all businesses to be a part of Time to Vote, whether you have one or two employees or 1 million employees. We welcome your participation in Time to Vote. And we are looking at every industry and in every state. We really want to be sure that all states are represented in our movement.
And Franz, we invited people to share their thoughts on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Corey writes, we have a holiday for every other thing. There should be a holiday for voting day. And Dave writes, Tuesday voting is voter suppression. Make Election Day a national holiday like the civilized world. Is that something you are working toward with Time to Vote? Or are you agnostic on the when we vote issue, just trying to make it easier for employees to do it whenever it happens?
You know, we've been agnostic on the actual day of the week. It's something that, our government needs to decide. But I would observe that in many, many, many parts of the world, Election Day is a holiday or on a weekend. And so it's something that, you know, we need in this country. We all need to step up and just be sure that everyone has the opportunity to participate. We can all do our jobs, but we should enable each other to be able to participate and be part of our democracy in a full-fledged way.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My only comment is that voting is one of our dearest and most sacred privileges. And if you can't use the current methods for voting, whether it's on the day of the election, whether it's early voting, either by mail or even early showing up at the polls at different places around the city or where you live, you're not smart enough to actually deserve the privilege of voting. Voting should not be something you have to pay someone to do or reward someone to do. It's a reward in and of itself, and it is such a privilege that we need to safeguard it, and people shouldn't be rewarded for doing their civic duty.
Charlie, thanks for the call. Corley, what do you think?
I agree that voting is a responsibility that we should all take very seriously, but I would argue that we need a culture shift. Not enough people participate in our democracy, and we think that the business community can play an important role in contributing to that culture shift that's needed to achieve greater participation in our elections.
Thanks for calling in, Charlie. We're talking to Corley Kenna from Patagonia and Franz Pasha of PayPal, looking at the business-led Time to Vote movement aimed at increasing voter participation by giving employees time to ensure that they can cast a ballot on Election Day and, as we heard, maybe even work at the polls. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you work for a company that gives you extra time off to go vote, or do you, because of your work, have a hard time making it to the polls on Election Day? Do you wish it was easier to go work the polls and get time off to do that? If you're an employer yourself, do you do something like this? Do you actually participate in this Time to Vote movement? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our conversation about the Time to Vote movement, with companies giving employees time out of their workday or time off to vote. Our guests are with two of the founding companies, Corley Kenna from Patagonia and Franz Pasha of PayPal. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a business owner, a CEO that's already joined the Time to Vote movement? Do you work for a company that does give you time to vote? I think Johnson Controls is one prominent Wisconsin company that has signed on. Is it difficult for you to vote sometimes with your work schedule, to vote on Election Day, or even to work the polls if you want to? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's bring on another caller now. Stan is with us in Hales Corners. Stan, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. I agree with Charlie. It is a civic duty to go vote, but I'm a lucky guy. I start at 7. I get home after 3:30. The polls are open from 8 to 8. I can get to the polls. But there's a lot of people that are working two jobs every day, and their shift might start before 7, and the first shift might end, and then they got to get to the other shift, and the polls are closed. Why can't we have a holiday or have time off to go vote? There's no reason not to have it. Every industrial country in the world gives people time off to go vote, and they make it a national holiday. And there's, in Wisconsin, we have pretty good participation. We always end up losing out to our brothers over in and sisters in Minnesota. But a lot of states, people just don't go to the polls because they're busy. They're working.
Stan, thanks a lot for calling in and sharing that. And Franz, that's a part of what you're looking for, the flexibility for the people who can't fit it in that easily.
Yeah. And Rob, I'd also add that, this year when we face the health concerns of a pandemic, it's going to take time, and there are going to be spatial distancing, physical distancing. People are going to, want to make sure they have the ability to vote, but also to take all the necessary precautions. We all want that. And it may take more time this year, but it's, elections are important, and we hope people will take the time and not feel bounded by other obligations that make it difficult for them to take that time.
Thanks for that call. And we are in a constant civic competition with our neighbors in Minnesota. That said, Corley, how are you and your colleagues at Time to Vote, I guess, measuring success, seeing if you're moving the needle on voter participation?
Sure thing. I mean, it really does come down to who comes out on November 3rd. And I think we felt really good after the 2018 midterms, after we had over 400 companies as a part of Time to Vote. We saw a real surge in turnout in those 2018 midterms. And so our success will be measured. Will we get to 60, 70, 80% participation in the November elections? If we do and we played a role in that, we'll continue our movement.
And you said 400, I think, in the last election, over 700 now, Franz, and I think I heard 1,000 as a goal. Are you seeing companies showing up almost day by day?
Yeah, I mean, the momentum has been great in the last several months. You know, we've had several hundred companies step up. You know, as we get close to the election, the momentum is building. There's a lot of energy from the companies who are participating to reach out to other companies. And I think to your question about how we think about success, part of what we're looking at is a culture change and how businesses of every size think about what are their obligations and their ways of participating in our democracy. So I think there's both the turnout on its face, but also that sensibility of what our obligations are.
And Corley, we've mentioned a couple times, this is going to be different in each business. If somebody wants to sign up and they're thinking, yeah, but how can I, as a healthcare provider or a restaurant chain owner or whatever, actually do this? Do you offer some advice and guidance on you know, how to fit it into the particular needs of a particular company?
We sure do. And so the first thing I would suggest, if you're a company that's interested in joining Time to Vote, please check out our website, which is maketimetovote.org. Reach out to us. We're glad to share best practices of other companies, how various companies accommodate to ensuring that workers don't have to choose between earning a paycheck and voting.
And Franz, we started off, I think we first noticed this when there was that exchange between comedian Sarah Silverman and Coca-Cola that apparently goaded them into signing on. Do you approve of the, you know, goading companies to try to shame them into joining the movement?
You know, we're not goading anyone. you know, I think this is our political process is filled with all types of free speech. But our approach is to inspire and to show by example that this works and to also really build this community of leaders at companies and teams at companies who believe in this, and we support each other and share best practices. And I think we are really building a movement, and it won't stop just at this election. It will be, you know, part of how we work forward.
And I should ask Corley before we wrap up, if there's a business owner, big or small, wondering how they can join, what do they do to get involved?
Really, that first step is visiting our website, maketimetovote.org. You can sign up directly there. You can learn a bit more about the principles behind our movement. You can see the other companies that are involved. So that's the first place to go, maketimetovote.org.
Thanks, Corley, for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
And Franz, thanks for being with us.
Really a pleasure. Thanks so much.
We've been talking to Corley Kenna, Senior Director of Global Communications and PR for Patagonia, and Franz Pasha, Senior Vice President of Corporate Affairs for PayPal. We talked to him today about the Time to Vote movement of business leaders, more than 700 companies so far, to give employees time off in order to cast their ballots on Election Day. You could still share your thoughts over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tourism in the small town of Wisconsin Dells is a billion-dollar business. Visitors from across the Midwest and beyond go there for water slides and the famous boat tours. But this year, there are fewer visitors. Workers are scarce, and outbreaks have closed down some of the most popular destinations. Rob Menser has more.
If there's a skyline in Wisconsin Dells, it's the twists of the water slides poking up into the sky. The town of fewer than 6,000 residents normally hosts more than 4 million tourists each year. There are about half a dozen huge resorts here with sprawling hotels and big water park attractions. But this year, this tourist town is facing massive challenges. As summer winds down, there are still families visiting. Janice Burris brought her kids and grandkids from Illinois to visit the Mount Olympus Water Park. The group of 12 wears masks in common areas of their hotel, but Burris isn't too worried about traveling during the pandemic.
I mean, you get tired after a while just ignoring your family and friends, so we decided, you know what, we're done with that.
Romy Snyder of the Wisconsin Dells Visitors Bureau says the resorts made complex reopening plans, with water parks reducing capacity and requiring temperature checks at their gates.
Businesses were just grateful that there were things they could do to either open or remain open.
The big resorts, though, are just part of the economy here. There are hundreds of small businesses that rely on the big influx of visitors each summer. 17-year-old Bella Hill works at a downtown candy shop. She says while there are fewer customers this year, there are also many fewer workers.
It's up to the local kids kind of this year. We don't have a lot of help, so some businesses, they can't even open.
Wisconsin Dells relies on foreign workers who come to the U.S. on student exchange visas. This year, because of the pandemic, many countries wouldn't allow workers to travel. In a normal summer, the Dells has about 3,600 guest workers. This year, there were 360. The students face increased risks because many live in densely packed dormitories. In April, an outbreak at one of the dorms required 190 to be quarantined for 2 weeks. Bella Hill says some downtown shops are so understaffed that the workers at competing stores have to run over and cover each other's breaks. She wears a mask at work, but she says not all of her customers do.
The amount of people that come into the store every day, like, we're exposed to a lot. And a lot of times they are not always cautious of the workers.
And there have been outbreaks. In late July, the general manager of Noah's Ark, which bills itself as America's largest water park, was fired after he wrote an email to health officials calling COVID-19 the, quote, phantom China virus and objecting to a proposed mask mandate. Just 2 weeks later, the park closed after two employees tested positive. They've announced that they won't reopen this year. Tim Lothar is the county health officer. He worked with resorts and other businesses to craft safety recommendations. He says it doesn't make sense to see public health as in opposition with business.
If people were to fully institute the public health recommendations, that we could get these businesses open and keep them open so that people would have the confidence to go in, feel safe and protected, and take advantage of the services that they provide. We have to get to that point, or this is just not going to end.
Tourism here in June was down about 40% from the previous year, though it picked up in July. But visits are expected to drop off again at the end of this month and in the fall, when most of the business in Wisconsin Dells comes from conventions. Most of those have been canceled or postponed until 2021. Rob Menser, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a new lawsuit is challenging Wisconsin's mask mandate, the statewide mandate. We'll hear from the legal. You can join in with some of your suggestions. Tanzina Vega joins the show, host of The Takeaway. That's the show you'll hear before Central Time starting next Monday. And what's funny to you may not be funny to people older or younger than you. We'll find out why there's a generation gap when it comes to humor and comedy. And you can get us started now. Send us an email or tweet us at CentralTimeWPR. Is there something, a point of comedic reference that just doesn't work between you and your kids or you and your parents or you and your coworkers of different generations? Or is there something that unites you across the generations? Let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. All that and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.